When Benito Garza rode north of the Rio Grande toward Tejas with Santa Anna, he had an opportunity to see why the Mexicano troops, officers and enlisted men alike, loved this dynamic man. He obviously thrived on campaign conditions and could hardly wait, Benito thought, to launch the attack. Forward, forward, was his constant command to himself and his troops. The dictator was going to be 42 years old the next day, the 21st of February, and he would spend it in the saddle, a few miles south of his ultimate target, the Alamo. The passing years had treated him well, and he looked, if the truth were voiced, and he liked it to be voiced, a good deal like one of Napoleon's marshals, Ney or Soult, or even like the emperor himself. On this campaign, he had brought along none of his mistresses, and Garza heard him complain to General Cos, "How can a gentleman celebrate his birthday alone?" So on Santa Anna's natal day, Cos ordered salutes to be fired and a ration of wine issued for celebration. The troops were now approaching the Medina, where Santa Anna had known his first great victory, with many, many more Anglo-rebels in the field then than there would be now. The general wanted to leave El Camino Real briefly and veer eastward toward the old battle site. But when this was done and the steep banks of the river reached, no one could locate exactly the scene of the battle, and Santa Anna was mildly displeased. On the day after his birthday, Santa Anna moved his troops to within sight of the tall tower of San Fernando Church, just across the river from the Alamo, and there he made camp early. Scouts rode in to inform him of conditions in the town, and everything he heard was reassuring. No reinforcements, and none on the way. Colonel Fannin and his large detachment bottled up at Goliad, and he refuses to move to Béjar. Still, no more than 150 men, but they do have some cannon. And the entire town, General, is eager to welcome you. Are there any Mexicanos fighting with them? This problem of loyalty irritated him. Captain Juan Seguin has taken arms against you, says he will fight for the Constitution of 1824. Do any support him? He led nine others into the Alamo. We have their names. Abamillo, Badillo, Espalier. He continued to read from the grubby paper, nine names in all. There to be hanged, not shot, hanged. Even as he gave this order, one of the Mexicanos slipped out of the Alamo, but the other nine were determined to oppose the dictator with their lives, in defense of a new Texas, which would later have little use for their kind. Garza rode with the general as he entered the town in the lead, disregarding the possibility of isolated sniper fire from some misguided rebel. No doubt about it, this man was brave. Turning back to face Garza, he gave a short command. "I want the flag I showed you last night to be flown immediately." And now they reached the heart of Béjar, with Garza pointing out the church. "Can its tower be seen at the Alamo?" the general asked. "Unquestionably." "Fly the flag." So Benito Garza climbed the quivering tower stairs, accompanied by two dragoons. And when they reached the highest practical point, he unfurled the big flag made from cloth which Santa Anna had brought north for this specific purpose. The rude flag was very large, perhaps 12 feet long and proportionately wide. But despite its size, it carried no symbol of any kind. Its message was its color, a bold, sullen, blood-red overall. As the flag unfurled, a breeze caught it and spread it majestically in the sky. Those who saw it and understood its military meaning gasped, for this was the flag of no surrender, no clemency. The soldiers who fought against it knew that they must either kill or be killed, because no prisoners would be taken. When Garza descended from the bell tower, an orderly informed him that the general wanted his assistance in translating an important document into English. The two men went to a house located in the smaller plaza between the church and the bridge leading across the river to the Alamo. Here, Santa Anna outlined the rules for this and all subsequent battles in the district of Tejas. They were, as he carefully pointed out, in strict conformance with international law and with the recently promulgated rules of the new dictatorship. Every Mexican who has fought with the rebels or in any way supported them is to be hanged, and I want no protracted trials. Just hang them for treason. Every American colonist who has taken arms against us, to be shot, and again, no trials. Those who supported the rebels but did not take arms, to be expelled forever from Mexican soil. All American immigrants, regardless of their sympathies, to be moved at least 100 miles south of the Rio Grande, whether they can bring their household goods or not. Absolutely no further immigration of any kind from the American states into Tejas or any other part of Mexico. The people of Tejas to repay every peso of expense incurred on this expedition to discipline them. Now, this is very important and is to be stressed in any pronouncement we make. Any foreigner in Tejas who is arrested while in the possession of arms of any kind is to be judged a pirate and treated accordingly. Finally, the flag up there tells it better than I can. Once the battle begins, if the enemy has not previously surrendered, no prisoners will be taken. Make this extremely clear. No prisoners are to be taken. They are to be shot on the battlefield where we capture them. Shortly thereafter, a white flag of truce showed at the Alamo, and a parley took place on the little bridge crossing the river. Here, the final terms were spelled out to the Americans in their own language. But they were, as Garza noted when he delivered them, somewhat softened. If you surrender unconditionally right now, lay down your arms, and take a pledge never to appear in Tejas again, your lives and property will be spared. Garza, hoping that actual battle could be avoided, and the invaders peaceably expelled, prayed that the Norteamericanos would accept these surprisingly generous terms. But when the emissary returned to the Alamo, the answer from there was delivered in the form of a cannon shot, whose roar reverberated across the main plaza. Santa Anna had his answer. He did not lose his temper. Coolly summoning his generals, he said, "We'll not throw our entire force against that silly fortress. We'll save it for later punishment of the entire state." "How do you propose knocking them out of their position?" General Coase asked, indicating the Alamo. "Siege. We'll strangle them, bombard them with cannon, and shoot them down when they collapse." "With your permission, Excellency," General Ripardá said, "I had long experience with Norteamericanos when I served at Nacogdoches. These scoundrels will not collapse." "Your Norteamericanos did not face Santa Anna." So the siege began, and no prisoners were to be taken alive. The customs of war, as observed by civilized nations, justified such terms for treasonous rebellion against a sovereign state, and that is exactly what the Texican rebels were engaged in. The sad fracture which threatened to destroy this lovely area was reflected in the names used by its people. Mexicanos called it the town of Béjar in Tejas, Texicans San Antonio in Texas, and between them no compromise seemed possible. The unfurling of the great red flag produced unexpected consequences in one San Antonio household. At the northern end of Soledad Street, in the old Veramendi place, Mordecai Marr and his Mexicana wife Amalia saw the flag lazily fluttering in the breeze and realized for the first time that this was to be a battle to the death. They had hoped that differences between the central government in Mexico and the provincial one in Tejas could be peacefully resolved. But now men had to make decisions. This was particularly difficult for the Mars. To begin with, they were citizens of Mexico. Of that there could be no doubt. She came from the grandest family in the region, with notable ties to the Veramendis of Saltillo. And her husband had embraced Mexican citizenship back in 1792, when he married her and came into possession of the vast ranch at El Coro. Not once in succeeding years had he even contemplated trying to regain his American citizenship. And in recent years, when minor troubles flared, he had been a pacifying agent, assuring American newcomers that the things they disliked could be easily corrected. But since the new year, two events had altered the family thinking. From a Zacatecan refugee connected to the Veramendis, they heard harrowing reports of Santa Anna's treatment of that city, and this had made them wonder whether such a leader could retain the goodwill of his Tejas citizens. More confusing, they learned that, inside the Alamo, among the handful of men preparing to defend it, was their respected relative, Jim Bowie of Kentucky. Back in 1831, this colorful outsider had married Ursula Veramendi, the winsome belle of the family. At first, the respectable Mexicano families of Saltillo and San Antonio predicted only bad consequences from such a union. But Bowie surprised them by becoming an ardent Catholic, a devoted husband, and a fine father to his and Ursula's children. Even the local priest had said, "The Jim Bowie marriage is one of the most reassuring in Tejas. Who would have expected it?" The Mars had deemed it imprudent to visit Jim inside the Alamo, for they certainly did not share his determination to resist Santa Anna. Also, when, in 1833, the lovely Ursula and her two children died of cholera, Bowie's essential ties with the Veramendi family were broken, and the Mars had not seen him since that tragedy. "He goes his way," Mordecai said to the old-timers, "and we go ours. But we respect him. Always have." So there it stood on the afternoon when the flag signaled, and the longer Mordecai contemplated this dreadful twist of events, the more perturbed he became. He ate no supper. Pacing back and forth in the study that he had come to love as the heart of his home, he thought of the curious forces which had brought him to this unlikely spot. He did not love the United States, and he actively disliked most of the immigrants he met. Nor did he love Tejas, but he still loved the freedom, the bigness of the land he had elected for his home, and he did not want to lose that. The men in the Alamo represented a striving to keep that freedom, while the men who had unfurled the flag of death could represent only repression. It was 9:30 when he walked soberly into the big room, where Amalia was busy with her needlework. And when he came upon her, as she sat with the flickering light behind her lovely head, he saw her as if for the first time. How happy they had been! He'd been on the verge of marrying the Saldana girl when Amalia Veramendi moved in to sweep him off his feet with her love, her wit, and her promises of a vast ranch if he married her. Never had he regretted the decision, although he did sometimes wonder what had happened to the Saldana girl, whose first name he could not now remember. "Amalia, I'm going to join Jim Bowie." "I will go with you." She said this so simply, her needlework in her lap, that he was overcome by her courage. But when he started to say that if she changed her mind— "What other choice could I have?" she interrupted, rising and kissing him. "We've had a wonderful life, Mordecai, because we always did everything together. Let's not change now." They spent less than an hour getting a few things together, and it was well before midnight when they left the Veramendi home and walked quietly down dark Soledad Street to the church square. There they turned left, walked through the small area subtended by the loop in the river, and approached the little footbridge leading to the Alamo. Santa Anna's guards stopped them, of course, but when Amalia told the officer, I'm the Veramendi woman. My family owns that house over there. They let her and her Mordecai pass. Once across the bridge, the proud couple, their white hair shining in the moonlight, turned, and without provoking any action on the part of the remaining guards, walked purposefully toward the old mission. When they were in hailing distance, an American patrolling the walls shouted at them, and Mordecai called back, "Veramendis, we come to see Jim Bowie." They could hear conversation inside, and then see the cautious opening of the gate. Quickly they slipped through, saw the huge area inside the walls, and a rather small room to the right, where Jim Bowie lay prostrate from a sudden attack of the fever. Amalia, hurrying to his cot, whispered, "Jim, Mordecai is here. We've come to be with you." And the sick man reached out to grasp their hands. The Mars found the Alamo dominated by four remarkable men. Two were wild frontier heroes, Jim Bowie in command of the Volunteers, and Davy Crockett. The other two were cool, well-educated gentlemen, Colonel William Travis, commander of the regular troops, and James Bonham, a quiet man with a personal courage matched by few and surpassed by none. The original homes of these four epitomized much of Texas history. The two frontiersmen were from Tennessee, of course, while the gentlemen were from South Carolina. On the character of these four would depend the defense of the Alamo. Next morning, when Senora Mar comforted the despondent Bowie, her husband explored the arena in which they would do battle. The huge, walled-in area astounded him. "We could move all the people of Bejar in here, and they'd fill only a corner." But as he walked about, surveying the walls and calculating their ability to withstand Mexican cannon fire, he learned the nature of this siege, for Santa Ana's artillery began their morning bombardment. After taking refuge under a shed, Mar watched while large cannonballs came drifting in over the walls, landed in the middle of the open area, and rolled harmlessly along until they came to rest against some obstruction, hurting no one, destroying nothing. Since the Mexican gunners seemed never to vary the position, aim, or elevation of their cannon, the balls invariably landed in the same harmless spot. And when Mar realized this, he snorted, "We can hold out a month against that stuff." While he was reaching this conclusion, Colonel Travis was working in a small room, as far from the barrage as possible, composing with a scratchy pen a letter that would be remembered in Texas history. Staring at the red flag, he knew that unless reinforcements arrived quickly, he and his men were doomed. But instead of surrendering, he threw his gauntlet into the face of the world. To the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Ana. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the ford is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character, to come to our aid with all dispatch. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due his honor and that of his country. Victory or death. William Barrett Travis. Substantial help was available in the countryside. At Goliad, some miles to the southeast, there was an organized branch of the army, and at Gonzales, due east, a random collection of untrained patriots. If these forces marched swiftly to the Alamo, it might be saved. When Zave Campbell heard that Santa Anna was marching north with more than 2,000 troops, his first thought was a practical one. I better get some cattle up to New Orleans. He therefore made hurried plans to get a herd together. But he was temporarily forestalled by the sudden disappearance of Garza and by the fact that Finlay McNabb, also apprehensive about the approach of Santa Anna, would not allow Otto to leave home at this critical time. Despite these two drawbacks, Zave felt that if he could but get to Gonzales and talk to the locals, he could enlist the help he needed there. Accordingly, he scurried about, grabbing items that would prove useful on the long drive, and issuing last-minute instructions to Maria. "With me gone, you can help the McNabs if they need it. Take care of yourself, Javier." In days to come, he would try to recall this scene, this parting with a woman he had grown to love late in his life, but he would be unable to do so. There was no significant speech, no meaningful farewell, and no commitment one way or another. He had left home often before, and he had never taken much account of parting then, nor did he now. "Goodbye, old lady. Ten cuidado." And he was gone, thinking only briefly of how stalwart a woman she was. He knew he'd been damned lucky to find her. Her brother? Ah, that was another matter. With Benito and his hot temper, one never knew. Probably heading south right now to join up with Santa Anna. Well, that was his business, and it did not affect Maria. In this life, all men, it seemed, had trouble with their in-laws. With that succinct summary of his family affairs as of the 12th of February, 1836, he followed the Guadalupe upstream for two full days and part of a third, after which he entered the little town of Gonzales, only to find it so involved with plans for war that any prospect of collecting cattle vanished. One rancher, who could have supplied hundreds, reported, "All my hands have quit. You ask me, they're on their way to fight for Santa Anna." The Gonzales men took this seriously, and for good reason. Only the previous October, the Mexican government had sent soldiers to Gonzales to repossess a cannon loaned to the town. The thinking had been that with agitation spreading throughout Texas for the establishment of a self-governing state, divorced from Coahuila, it was prudent to confiscate any weapons which might be used against government troops. To the amazement of the Mexican officers, the men of Gonzales had refused to surrender their cannon. Instead, they used the thing to lob cannonballs at the troops, then unfurled an insulting flag showing a rude drawing of the cannon and the inscription, neatly lettered, "Come and take it." The whole affair was absurd, really, because the so-called cannon was a midget affair, so small that two men could drag it along. But it did throw a much larger ball than a rifle, so it was, technically, a cannon. And the men, exhilarated by their defeat of the Mexican army, one trooper killed, began referring to their brief skirmish as the Lexington of the Texican Revolution. If Santa Anna really was on his way to Texas, one of his first and most brutal stops would be at Gonzales. Campbell, irritated by this interruption of his plans, moved from one former customer to another, pleading with them to assign him the cattle he needed for his drive to New Orleans. But they were preoccupied. Disgusted, he stopped on the following morning at the store of the widow Fuqua to pass the time in idle conversation. "How did a Jew get to a town like this?" "We travel to all parts, always have." "Where did you come from?" "All parts." "You any idea how I might get my cattle together?" Mrs. Fuqua had no suggestions, for as she reminded Zave, all the Mexicans had fled. At this moment, the shopkeeper's young son, Galba, entered, and Zave asked, "How old are you, son?" And the lad replied, 16. "How'd you like to help me herd a string of cattle to New Orleans?" The prospect of such an excursion delighted the boy, small for his age, but much like Otto in his apparent ability, and he responded enthusiastically, "If mother allows." When Mrs. Fuqua nodded, Zave said, "I'll take care of your son, but first we got to gather our herd." "That can be done," the boy said. and on the spot he outlined a plan whereby he and two friends, one of them a lad his own age named Johnny Gaston, could collect the longhorns as effectively as any Mexicans. "We can ride and rope." Permission was granted by the owners, who were glad to see their stock moved out of the way of an incoming danger, and by Tuesday, the 23rd, it began to look as if Campbell would succeed in getting his drove on the road before the beginning of March. But on Wednesday, about noon, two dusty horsemen galloped in from the west, with a written plea from the American commander in the Alamo. "The enemy in large force is in sight. We want men and provisions. Send them to us. We have 150 men and are determined to defend the Alamo to the last. Give us assistance." Now all talk of cattle vanished. Men spoke only of what could be done to aid their imperiled fellows trapped in San Antonio, and many wild proposals involving no risk were made. But suddenly, the aching truth was voiced. "We have got to march a relief force into the Alamo." On Thursday, the discussion resumed, and now all listened intently as the messengers honestly laid forth the situation. Santa Ana has nearly 2,000 men there already, with more marching in daily. We have no more than 150. But think of the men we do have. Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, this young wild man, William Travis. With your help, they can win. "Men of Gonzales, if you do not support us now, the Alamo will fall. Santa Ana will march to your town and destroy it. Upon you depends the freedom of Texas. And you know that on the freedom of Texas depends the freedom of the United States. You must act now." These ringing words evoked a flurry of patriotism throughout the town, and women began assembling supplies should their men decide to march. But the decision could be reached only painfully, for the men of Gonzales were intelligent enough to know that odds against them of 2,000 to 150 were perilous. It was clearly understood that anyone who entered the Alamo within the next few days stood a very good chance of dying there, and almost no chance whatever of holding the fortress indefinitely against the overwhelming power of the enemy. On these harsh terms, the debate began. One man asked, "Did not General Houston advise Travis to abandon the Alamo, knock down the walls, and let the Mexicans have it?" "He did," a messenger snapped. His knee had been badly wrenched during an intrepid scout he had made of the oncoming Mexican forces as they approached San Antonio, and he was impatient with these thoughtful, careful men. "If I can risk my life on that damned horse, not 100 yards from the whole Mexican army, why can't they see the crisis at the Alamo?" Controlling his temper, he said, "General Houston did order the place abandoned. But it is always the man on the spot who must make the final decision, and Travis, after weighing everything, decided to dig in and fight. Now you must make your decision." On Friday, the 26th of February, the men of Gonzales were beginning to think that maybe they should organize a relief party and march to the support of the men in the Alamo, and by noon, the momentum to join that party became an emotional bonfire which engulfed the town. 20 men signified their willingness, then another 5, then still another 5. Then the richest man in town, Thomas R. Miller, whose young wife had recently run off with a more attractive fellow. By nightfall, 31 men had volunteered to lay down their lives, if necessary, in defense of freedom. And among them were 2 of the boys on whom Zave Campbell had been depending to gather his cattle, Galba Fuqua and Johnny Gaston, brother of the young girl who had run away from Miller. Zave Campbell, idle through no fault of his own, did not jump to volunteer. This was not his war, as the husband of a wonderful Mexican woman who became more precious the more he thought of her. He bore no general animosity toward Mexicans. And, as a man who had been damn near hanged by loud-mouthed Texicans, he felt no responsibility to them. But with nothing better to do, he did watch from the sidelines as they formed in their final muster, and a more disorganized group of would-be heroes he had never seen. Short boys and gangly men, lads who had never shaved, and oldsters with wandering beards, they were all dressed differently, with not a single item of true military dress in the lot. If they wore hats, they were big and floppy. Their shoes were shapeless and worn. Their homespun trousers were of a dozen different sizes, lengths, and thicknesses. A few wore bandoliers. A few had improvised knapsacks. Two had bayonets on their long rifles. But each seemed to have a long-bladed knife, and three had a pair. When the roll call was completed, the newly elected officer announced, "We march at noon tomorrow." And that night, Zave found it difficult to sleep. He felt no urge to choose sides, but he had to respect the courage of these rude countrymen who felt obligated to defend their freedoms. So, as the long night waned, he felt himself drawn ever closer to the patriots. He spent Saturday morning watching odd corners of the town where volunteers bade farewell to their families. And as he saw these emotional scenes, he became so confused that when the line formed for the march to the Alamo, he quietly joined at the rear. In the entire history of Texas, there would be none braver than these 32 from Gonzales. For each man in this heroic file could say to himself, between thundering heartbeats, "I know I'm marching to almost certain death, and I know it's insane, but I prize freedom above life itself." Finley McNabb, an orderly man of 44, was downright disgusted at the chaos into which Tejas had fallen even before Santa Anna fired his first gun. As he explained with some bitterness to Otto, "It's a damned disgrace. We have an army of maybe 2,000 men, but our shaky government has appointed 4 supreme commanders, and each one holds a commission which confirms that he is superior to the other 3. McNabb was correct. A wavering revolutionary government, unsure whether it wanted statehood within Mexico, jointure with the United States, or a free nation of its own, had appointed Sam Houston, vainglorious but demonstrably able, as commander-in-chief of the army on the basis of his militia rank years ago in Tennessee. But they had also designated Colonel James Fannin, a West Point man but not a graduate, as commander of the regular army contingent and subsidiary to no one. Rump forces within the government had given still another command to Dr. James Grant, born in Scotland and since 1825 owner of an enormous ranch west of Saltillo. A volatile man, much hated in northern Mexico, he had served in the governing body of Coahuila y Texas until Santa Anna prorogued it and now sought revenge. The fourth contestant for top honors was an irascible Virginia, Alabama, Illinois schoolteacher and greengrocer with military delusions. At a time of crisis in 1835, he had assumed command of a privateering force that had captured the Alamo from General Cos and sent him kiting back to Mexico under pledge never to return under arms. Commander-in-Chief Frank W. Johnson had his own plans for subduing Mexico. In executing them with total ineptness, he would lose his entire force save 4, but he himself would escape and live another 48 years, during which he would write a 5-volume history of the times he had seen and the heroisms he had performed. There was, of course, a 5th commander, almost insanely jealous of the other 4, and possibly more gifted as a military leader than any of them, Colonel William Travis, who still held on to the Alamo in gross disobedience to orders from General Houston that he abandon it and blow it up. These 5 warring commanders led forces totaling only 2,000 troops. All Santa Anna had to do was knock them off one by one, and this he was in the process of accomplishing. "It's insane," McNabb said to his son as they chopped wood on their farm along the Guadalupe. "A man would be crazy to get himself involved in such nonsense." Consequently, he was not moved when on the 8th of January, Colonel Fannin sent a horseman through the countryside with an urgent call for volunteers to help him defend the eastern lands around Victoria. So the McNabs refused to attend the big organizing effort, at which more than 100 late arrivals with a Georgia battalion whooped and cheered as they joined the Fannin Crusade. A lively group of Irish immigrants, who had recently taken up land in the nearby Irish colonies, made even more noise when they enlisted. And equally valued were four well-trained Polish engineers who reported from the scattered Polish settlers in the area. Just as their countryman, Thaddeus Kosciuszko, had built most of General Washington's fortifications during the Revolution, they would assume responsibility for perfecting Fannin's defenses. McNab, listening to reports of how successful the meeting had been, had reason to hope that in this command, at least, things would move forward intelligently, and he concluded that he and his son could leave the prosecution of this war to the enthusiasts. He was startled when he learned that this odd assortment of would-be soldiers had moved practically into his backyard, fortifying themselves noisily in the abandoned presidio at Goliad, less than 30 miles from the McNab farm. He could no longer escape the fact that the war had encroached upon him. Even so, he remained reluctant to associate himself with what he feared would be a disastrous experience. And he was in this confused, gloomy frame of mind when on the 18th of February, a 29-year-old man of the most compelling honesty galloped unattended into nearby Goliad with urgent news. He was Lieutenant James Bonham, a lawyer from South Carolina, whose heroic longings had been ignited by reports of what the Texas Patriots were attempting. Like so many others whose names would soon glorify Texas history, he had arrived only recently in the territory, less than 3 months before. But his cool enthusiasm was so respected that he was quickly made an officer, whereupon he volunteered for service in the Alamo. Now, as danger threatened that bastion, he had, at incredible risk, broken through the enemy cordon and ridden eastward for help. And the men at Goliad listened in deepening apprehension as he informed them of the facts about the Alamo. Our side has 150 men. Santa Ana has nearly 2,000 already, with more on the way. The odds sound impossible, but with the kind of heroes we have, I mean the determination, the steady fire they're capable of, I believe we can hold the fort till the rest of Texas mobilizes. What we need now is for every fighting man in this part of Texas to rush to the Alamo, strengthen our perimeters, give us help, start to march now. The freedom of Texas and the whole United States lies in the balance. Help us. Colonel Fannin, listening attentively to the plea, assured Bonham that he would think it over, whereupon the impetuous young lieutenant saluted, trying to hide his anger at this vacillation, and spurred his horse onward to Victoria. There he assembled the local farmers, to whom he delivered his message with such dramatic force that young Otto McNab blurted out, "Where are you going next?" And Bonham said, without hesitation, "Back to the Alamo." "Can I go with you?" The South Carolinian looked down at the boy and said, "Take your father to Goliad. March with Colonel Fannin and his men. They are going to reinforce us." "Will you go back alone?" Otto asked. "I came alone." He said this so simply, so sweetly, as if he were talking to a woman about strolling through a park, that Otto was enthralled. This was the kind of man he longed to be with, and he watched with tumultuous agitation as the former lawyer turned westward toward his elected station in the Alamo. He had fought his way out of that fortress, and now he was prepared to fight his way back in. As he disappeared, Otto asked his father, "If things are so bad, why does he go back in?" And Finley replied, "I doubt he considered any other possibility." That night, neither McNab could sleep. Otto's head was filled with images of galloping horses, challenges at dusk, guns blazing, and a lone man leaping his horse across obstacles. His father's visions were more controlled and much more sober. He saw a beleaguered Texas, chaotically led, staggering and fumbling its way toward liberty. And he saw the irresistible logic of Bonham's plea. Unite with us. Help us. Give us the time we need till Texas mobilizes. All night these words rang in his ears, growing more forceful with each reiteration, until toward dawn he rose and walked alone beside the river that he had grown to love. It was peaceful now, a beautiful river, home of birds and haven for thirsty animals, and it had become a real home for him. Looking up to the branches of the trees that stood along its bank, he could see debris from the last terrible flood many feet above his head. Texas is in flood, he told himself as the sun rose, and no one can predict where the debris will finally rest. At breakfast, he told Josefina, Otto and I better get ready to leave. When she asked, For what? He told her in Spanish, We must go to Goliad. To fight against my people. Your people are fighting against us. She sat down with her apron brought to her face as if to hide tears, and said sorrowfully, I think maybe so. But what it was she truly thought, she did not confide. She was further distressed when Otto left, obviously to say farewell to Maria Campbell, whom he loved first and strongest. But at noon, when the boy returned, she and Findlay had all things packed, and the two McNabs headed southwest for the Presidio at Goliad. On leap year day, General Santa Anna's equerry came to Benito Garza and said, I want you to find some soldier about 30 years old who could look like a priest. Why? Do as you're told. So Garza wandered among the troops, looking for someone who might resemble a priest if properly garbed. And by chance, he came upon a real priest serving the troops, a Father Palacio, whom he took to the adjutant. To Garza's surprise, the officer was infuriated, and although he tried to mask his rage while the priest was present, as soon as the clergyman departed, he slapped Garza across the face and shouted, Do as you're told, damn you! Benito was so astonished by this insulting treatment that he resumed his search in anger, and finally found a rather fat fellow who looked as if he might play the drunken friar in a barracks room comedy put on by locals. Leading him like a child to the equerry, Garza said hopefully, I think this one will do. And to his relief, the officer said, So do I. Now find him the clothes. What clothes? Benito asked. And again the equerry started to slap him. But this time Benito grabbed the man's wrist, twisting it savagely, as he whispered in a shaking voice, You do that again, I kill you. The young officer, stunned that a man he took to be a peasant should behave so, reached forward as if to strike Garza. But when he saw Benito's flaring nostrils and grim eyes, he drew back. In a chastened voice he said, We need some priest's clothes. This proved a more difficult task, but after more than an hour spent searching, Benito came upon an old woman in the main plaza who said that a priest who had once boarded in her house had died. She found remnants of his habit, and when it was fitted to the fat soldier, he did indeed look like a priest. Garza knocked on the equerry's door, and when that officer saw the soi-disant priest, he was delighted. Just what we need. And he hurried both Garza and the priest down Soledad Street to the Veramendi house, where, in the old courtyard with the fountain playing, a wedding party had assembled. Benito met the bride, a lively, attractive girl of 19, whose mother had succeeded in protecting her from half a dozen officers who had tried to capture her. She marries this one, and that's the only way. Refusing even colonels any access to her daughter, she had proclaimed repeatedly that she and her mother before her were ladies of high quality and rigorous morals, and that she intended keeping her daughter that way. In the end, apparently some officer had surrendered and proposed marriage, but it was clear to Garza, and to the equerry at least, that the wedding was to be a cynical charade performed by a fake priest. Benito was indignant at this, for the woman and her daughter were respectable Mexicanas, and here the Mexicano army was treating them with the same contempt the Texicans did. He had expected better from Santa Ana's men. The general himself had repeatedly expressed to Garza his respect for the locals, assuring him that once the Norteamericanos were evicted, men like Garza would assume command and make Tejas a rich and leading province within the Mexicano system. Benito thought it a good thing that Santa Ana did not know of this burlesque, for he was sure the general would have halted it. But at this moment cheers erupted, and all heads turned admiringly to greet the lucky bridegroom, who marched sedately from the interior of the palace, bestowing nods and smiles on all. It was Santa Ana himself, solidly married in Jalapa, with numerous children, and with at least 7 mistresses in the capital. As the tedious siege had worn on day after day, he felt he needed amusement, and had found it in the person of this lively lass, who seemed to reciprocate his feelings. But her mother had imposed such a rigorous regime, never allowing her daughter a moment to herself, that in disgust Santa Ana had proposed marriage, an honorable gesture which threw the mother into paroxysms of joy. "I could tell you were a perfect gentleman," she assured him, and he indulged her when she wanted to make the wedding a gala affair. But he had put his foot down when she proposed to invite the entire Mexicano population of Beja to the ceremony, to relieve the boredom of the fighting, she had said, because he feared that some civilian would be aware that he was already married and would condemn this mock wedding as a fake. As he stepped into the center of the crowd, he bowed low before the fatuous mother, kissed her hand reverently, and said, "This is the happiest day of my life." And she responded, "With me the same." And so the preposterous wedding party formed, there in the lovely Veramendi Gardens, where Jim Bowie had often sat with his beloved Ursula, and the bogus priest was moved forward, mumbling some lines and fumbling with the Bible. And the fat fellow, who really did look the part, pronounced the handsome couple man and wife. When he added, "You may now kiss the bride," Santa Ana swept the willing young lady into his arms and carried her into the adobe palace, where the marriage was consummated within minutes. For many tumultuous hours the newlyweds stayed in their room, uttering squeals and chuckles that seeped out into the hallways, where the adoring mother relished each echo. And then, late in the afternoon of Tuesday, the 1st of March, the general appeared in the garden, his uniform pressed by his new mother-in-law, to issue a rapid chain of commands. Protected by a convoy of soldiers who could be spared from the siege, his bride was to be taken immediately south to San Luis Potosí, where she was to be given every consideration. He had reason to hope that she was pregnant, and if so, he wanted the child to be treated at least as generously as his other bastards. His mother-in-law was to be given the best house in Béjar and a pension, and to be kept as far removed from him as possible. Now he plunged vigorously into preparations for bringing the siege to a rousing conclusion. Summoning his aides, he learned from them the gratifying news that, through late arrivals, his army had now grown to 2,400 effectives. "Excellent. They have 150. Our superiority, 16-1. "Excuse me, Excellency. While you were..." The colonel hesitated. "Resting. About 30 additional rebels slipped into the mission. We believe they now have about 180. "Fools," Santa Ana muttered, "fighting to commit suicide." Recalculating his figures, he came up with the accurate discrepancy. 13 of us to every rebel. It was obvious that he could charge the walls head-on if he was willing to waste the manpower. When it became evident that the siege was not going to force the rebels to surrender in the near future, since they had all the beef they needed and more than enough water from their two wells, Santa Anna summoned General Ripardà and said graciously, "You were right. We'll have to storm the walls." But before issuing the final order, which could entail the loss of perhaps 1,000 of his men, he wanted to see for himself the exact state of preparation at the Alamo. So on March 4th, he asked his brother-in-law, General Cos, and 3 scouts, including Garza, to take a long ride with him around the former mission. As they crossed the little bridge leading to the east side of the river, Benito cautioned the dictator, "Excellency, do not ride carelessly. Remember, those men in there have what they call Kentucky rifles." "Every army thinks it has superior weapons." "But these are superior." "Son, I fought these rebels at Medina in 1813. They possessed nothing to fear, not even personal bravery. We fired at them, and they ran." "Excellency, have you ever seen a Kentucky rifle in action?" When Santa Anna said no, Benito told him, "This is one. I bought it from a Kentucky man himself. How far do you think it can fire with accuracy?" Santa Anna, always interested in firearms, said authoritatively, "Our muskets, in good condition, 90 yards, maybe 100. "More like 60," Cos said. "See that tree," Garza asked, "with the paper under it? Maybe some bottles? How far?" The officers agreed that it might be as much as 250 yards. "Watch," Benito said. And with careful aim he sped a bullet right into the collection of trash, throwing paper and bits of glass high in the air. "Incredible," Santa Anna said, drawing away from the still distant Alamo. "And remember, Excellency, the Norte Americanos established a rule in their 2 wars against the British. Always fire for the gold." "And what does that mean?" "My frontier friends told me, never fire aimlessly. Never fire at the common soldier. Always aim at the gold decoration of the officer. Today you are wearing your gold medals, Excellency." Prudently, the little party moved to a distance of about 300 yards, where, with a map, they circled the huge grounds of the Alamo. And as they rode from south to north, the 3 scouts relayed to Santa Anna the information they had accumulated. "The fortified main gate at the south will be impossible to breach. This long west wall is only adobe, but it's very thick. Rooms inside. You can see the patrol already on the roof. This north wall slopes at an angle and is not very stout. Difficult to climb, but our cannon could breach it for certain. Here on the east, a very stout wall. Don't try to force it. Those big square things are cattle pens, and the garden with one of the wells. Barracks there for the soldiers. If you try to break in here, you have to penetrate 2 sets of walls. And now, the chapel of the old mission. No roof, but extremely thick walls. I doubt they will waste much time defending this, because even if we did break through, we wouldn't be anywhere. But that stretch which connects the chapel to the main south wall could prove to be their weak spot and our big opportunity. Look, it has no wall of any kind, only a ditch in front, wooden palisades of a sort, mostly brush, I think. It will be defended, of course, and they may put their best rifles there, but it can be breached." At the conclusion of this tour, which took nearly an hour, Santa Anna told Cos, "We will attack with great force from the north and knock a hole in that exposed wall with no houses behind it. But we will also attack with maximum clamor the palisade and hope to divert their forces." "The church?" an officer asked, referring to the roofless chapel. What of that, Excellency? Attack it in force, but not seriously. Just enough to keep the defenders pinned down at a meaningless spot. Now the deployments were made. We'll attack from all sides at 4 o'clock Sunday morning. We should have the place by sunrise. He wheeled his beautiful horse, turned back to take one last look at the Alamo, and said, Remember, no prisoners. From the church tower, the red flag of death underscored that decision. When the McNabs arrived at Goliad toward dusk on Saturday, the 20th of February, they found affairs in much greater confusion than even Finlay had anticipated. He had assumed that Colonel Fennin, in response to Lieutenant Bonham's plea, would have his men preparing to make a dash into the Alamo. Instead, he learned that the two other supreme commanders, Grant, the malodorous Scotsman, and Johnson, the wild-eyed Illinois greengrocer, had marched off on their own in the fatuous belief that with only 60-odd untrained volunteers they could capture the important Mexican port of Matamoros near the mouth of the Rio Grande. Even their own scouts reported that General Urrea, one of the ablest Mexican leaders, had assembled more than 1,000 well-armed veterans there. What kind of madness is that? Finlay asked, after he and his son had been assigned places to sleep inside the Presidio walls. It gets worse, an embittered member of the Georgia Battalion groused. We should be on our way to the Alamo right now, but look at him. And for the first time, Finlay McNabb, a man whose frontier experiences had converted a somewhat aimless character into one of surprising fortitude, witnessed at close quarters the confusion and lack of decisiveness which characterized Colonel Fennin. 32 years old, and disappointed because of his failure to graduate from West Point with a commission in the regular United States Army, he had become a slave trader for a while, then an eager drifter looking for something to turn up. He was an adventurer, inordinately ambitious, now in Texas looking for promotion to general and reluctant to throw his forces into the Alamo, not because of cowardice or fear of death, but rather because if he were to do so, he would lose his command and be forced to serve under the despised amateur, Colonel Travis. On his visit to Goliad, Lieutenant Bonham had pleaded with all the considerable moral force he could muster for Fennin to march to the relief of the Alamo. Fennin had given an equivocal answer. He would go, he would not go, he would consider it. 6 days later, on the 23rd, he was still weighing alternatives after Santa Anna had surrounded the Alamo, so that reinforcements would now encounter serious trouble if they tried to enter. McNabb wondered if valiant troops, ready for battle, had ever been led by an officer so pusillanimous. I wish we could light a fire under him to see if he'd jump. Otto, listening to the complaints of the Georgia and Irish units, decided, If either father or Uncle Zave was leading, we'd be on our way to San Antonio now. Then, eyes blazing, he thought, And if Lieutenant Bonham had anything to do with it, we'd already be there. Fennin allowed the most contradictory rumors to agitate his men. We're marching to Gonzales. No, it's to Victoria, to unite with reinforcements coming by sea. No, that would be a retreat, and I heard Colonel Fennin swear on a stack of Bibles, I will never retreat. We march to San Antonio tomorrow to do what we can. The ridiculous truth was that Fennin had given each of these orders within the space of days, and had then countermanded each one. However, on the 25th of February he finally made up his mind. Tomorrow at dawn we march to help defend the Alamo. On the morning of Friday the 26th, Finlay and Otto joined the 320 soldiers from the Goliad Presidio, and the hearts of all beat a little quicker at the realization that they were at last marching to the Alamo. Colonel Fennin, astride a chestnut stallion, rode to the head of his troops, raised his sword, and cried, On to destiny! But his expedition had progressed only 200 yards when one of the major supply wagons broke down, and by the time it was repaired, other wagons that had taken the lead failed to negotiate a river crossing, so that total confusion resulted. Noon found the column stalled, and the afternoon wasted away without any significant movement. As day faded into night, McNabb realized that in these 14 hours the expeditionary force had covered less than a quarter of a mile. At dawn on the 27th, Colonel Fannin awakened to the ugly fact that he faced a 70-mile march to the next replenishment depot without sufficient food to sustain his troops. Having relied upon a swift dash to the first depot, he had not bothered to bring along emergency supplies. When McNabb heard that Fannin was going to ask his men to vote as to whether they wanted to move ahead to the Alamo or return to the safety of the Presidio and regroup, he was outraged. "A commander doesn't ask for a vote," he told the Georgians and Irishmen near him. "He senses in his gut what must be done, and he does it." But then an Irishman with a wizened, knowing face said, "He's taking the loss of that first wagon as an omen. Don't go on," a little voice is surely whispering to him. "My God," a Georgia man asked in disgust, "are we being led by omens?" "In this army we are," the Irishman said. But he was wrong, for Fannin was collecting his commissioned officers to ascertain how they interpreted not the omens, but the hard facts. "Gentlemen, we face a most serious situation. We have, as you well know, inadequate provisions for a long march and no reasonable means of increasing them. We have faulty transport and no way of finding better. Our artillery pieces seem too heavy to drag over riverbeds. And what seems most important to me, by leaving the Presidio without proper garrison, we tempt the enemy to sneak in and take it. What do you recommend that we do?" In the face of such a pessimistic review, the vote was unanimous: return to Goliad, bolster the fortifications, and defy the enemy from inside the walls. The Alamo? Nothing can be done from this end to support it. So the expedition stumbled back to its launching spot, retreated within the safety of its walls, and began a crash program with two objectives: build the walls so strong that they would be impregnable, slaughter so many oxen and dry the meat so carefully that the men would never again be short of rations. Finally, McNabb warned his son, "When a commander loses his nerve, disasters can happen." "What shall we do?" Otto asked. "Nothing." Then, afraid that his son might be as disoriented as Fannin, he asked, "Why? Did you want to leave?" Otto could not explain in words, but the more he witnessed the ineptitude inside the Presidio, the more he longed to serve with someone of honorable purpose like James Bonham. He was sure that Bonham would have quickly handled the perplexities that immobilized Fannin, and in the meantime, he, Otto, would keep his rifle clean and await the battle he knew to be inevitable. Just about this time, an event occurred inside the Alamo which would have given Otto reassurance. James Bonham, surveying the situation with Colonel Travis and Davy Crockett, concluded that he must ride once again through the countryside in a last appeal to Fannin at Goliad and to the scattered farmers in the east for aid. Crockett, hearing his decision, said, "You were lucky last time, threading your way out and back in. This time?" As if he knew no care in the world, the Carolina gentleman half-saluted Travis, smiled at Davy, and mounted the mare that had served him so well before. Darting suddenly from the north wall of the Alamo, he spurred his mount and galloped directly through the Mexican lines. Before the startled besiegers could prevent it, he had broken free and was on his way back to Goliad to make one final desperate plea for help. Like the demon rider in an ancient ballad, Bonham rode through the night, and on the 28th reined in at the Goliad Presidio, where the men cheered him lustily, for they knew what heroism his mere appearance at that spot, so distant from the Alamo, entailed. Bonham's arrival did not impress Colonel Fannin, for it reopened questions long since resolved. There would be no rescue operation conducted from Goliad, and patiently he explained why. Distance too great, transport too chancy, cannon too heavy, food and water too uncertain. On and on he went, reciting the best arguments in the world against any desperate lunge to the northwest. And as Bonham listened, he had to concede that everything Fannin said was true and relevant. Any cautious commander would hold back, as he was doing. But any brave commander would correct the disadvantages and forge ahead. By the middle of the next afternoon, Bonham had argued so persuasively that he was within minutes of persuading Fannin to act, when one of those freak accidents which so often determine history occurred. Bumptious Colonel Johnson, who had been trying to invade Mexico with a handful of heroes, stumbled into the Presidio with a harrowing story. "We were surrounded by Mexicans, chopped to pieces. Only four others survived." "From your entire force?" Fannin asked, his hands shaking. "And Dr. Grant, he seems to be lost." "My God," Fannin cried. For this meant that the two inept leaders had lost a large part of his total force, and Bonham saw that it was futile to pressure this confused man any further. His will was gone, and he had best be left alone. But when he looked at Johnson, he had to think, his army lost, all but five killed, yet he comes back alive to report. How? Aware that he had wasted precious hours listening to such men demean themselves, Bonham saluted his unworthy superiors and told them that he must get on with his duty. "And what is that?" Fannin asked. "Return to the Alamo. Colonel Travis deserves a reply." "But the place is surrounded. You said so." "I got out. I'll get back in." "Stay here with us. Help us defend Goliad." Bonham looked at the two men with whom he would not care to defend anything, then at the walls they had been reinforcing. He said nothing, but thought, "Fannin will pin himself into another Alamo, and 3 weeks from now he will be sending out cries for help." Turning his back on the two futile commanders, confused in competence, lusting for power, but incapable of the action by which it is earned, Bonham, the medieval knight resurrected for service in modern Texas, rode off toward duty. He carried with him no promises of aid, no hope for rescue, only the mournful confirmation that Texas was in mortal danger.